The discipline of dispassion, about which we were discussing, is a part of the education of the mind, by which it is purified and enabled to return to its essential nature. The vairagya or the spirit of renunciation that the yoga speaks of is a very subtle attitude of consciousness, and it is not any kind of outward conduct or behavior merely. It is not an abandonment of things in the pure physical sense. Though a safe distance from attractive physical objects may be conducive to this internal discipline of dispassion, but mere physical distance from objects of sense is not what is meant here, because the desire of the mind can connect it with its objects even in under conditions which are physically very remote and out of its reach. Physical distance does not prevent the mind from desiring, and therefore a mere physical isolation is not the entire meaning of renunciation. It is an inward transformation that has to take place, by which consciousness, or in its more pronounced form, mind, does not relate it to its objects. The object of sense can be physical or conceptual, and one can be attached to a conceptual object even though there may be no physical object. And as far as attachment is concerned, it makes not much difference whether its object is physical or purely psychological, because inward reveries of mind are as dangerous as outward possessive attitudes. But most students of yoga do not go deep into this peculiar feature of dispassion, and they go by life in a nunnery or a convent, etc. That is not what is ultimately required of us. You may live in a convent, you may live in a monastery, it is no use if the mind is hankering for enjoyment. The mind can be in the thick of enjoyment even inside a monastery or a nunnery. And what binds us is this craving of the mind. And what makes us take a rebirth is this craving of the mind. And merely because you are in a monastery or a church, it does not mean that you are a renunciate. Because the conditions of bondage are still present in the mind. And those factors which will bring about rebirth also are present in the mind. It is not the physical object of sense that causes rebirth. It is a mental potentiality, a predisposition of the mind towards something that causes rebirth. The mind can harbor within itself, inwardly, an abundance of pleasurable feelings and feel happy. You can be inwardly happy by enjoying a psychological object. There is no need for a physical object always. The senses can get excited by even a thought of the object of sense. And it is this excitement that causes pleasure and not the object. So whenever the nerves or the senses are stimulated, there is a sensation of pleasure. It may be that the physical proximity of an external object stirs the nerves and the senses in this manner. And we are hankering after a physical object of sense merely because it acts as an instrument in stirring up the nerves and the senses. The pleasure is not caused by the object, it is the stirring of the feeling, the sensations and the nerves that is the source of pleasure. This is very important to remember. You are happy because of a stimulation of the bodily organism, not because of the presence or the absence of the object outside, that is a different matter altogether. We make a mix-up of things and in a confused attitude imagine that the joy comes from the object which we are thinking of, loving or attached to. What actually happens is that an inward stimulation takes place. And this stimulation can be brought about merely by thought. Even if the object is 1,000 miles away, you can merely think that object and you will have a stimulation of the senses correspondingly felt. And you will have a similar type of joy and pleasure felt within you. Deep psychologists and psychoanalysts will tell you the details of this peculiar character of the mind. It is the mind that creates an atmosphere of satisfaction and joy by a rearrangement of its own constituents. And merely because an external circumstance helps in the arrangement of its psychological constitution does not mean that the joy comes from the object only. So the point that we are trying to drive home to our mind is that merely because we are away from physical objects of sense, it does not mean that we are in a state of renunciation. And yoga is not prescribing this sort of renunciation. What it expects of us is a healthy attitude of consciousness towards things. It does not expect us to brood over objects of sense. mostly our renunciation is compulsive. It is forced upon us by outward conditions. And this is a dangerous type of life that one can live, at least from the point of view of psychological health. Any kind of undue pressure exerted upon us is contrary to the requirement of yoga, because every stage of yoga is a spontaneity and a voluntary enterprise on the part of the seeker. Wherever there is an absence of spontaneity of action, there is a drudgery felt within. You enjoy a work when you do it of your own accord. You dislike a work when it is forced upon you by your boss. You can walk 10 miles if it is your wish to go as a sort of diversion or a play. But you will not walk even one for long if I send you on a duty. You will say, I cannot walk so much. You give to a car or a scooter. But you will walk 10 miles if it is your wish. So voluntary and spontaneous aspiration is called for in yoga. And when Patanjali, the teacher, lays great emphasis on the requisite of vairagya or renunciation, what he intends is to convey to us the message that bondage from which yoga tries to free us is not merely in a physical location of objects of sense, but in a connection of consciousness with these locations of objects, and an appreciation by the mind of the characters of these objects. You cannot enjoy an object unless you appreciate it. And this appreciation is the recognition by the mind of certain characters or values in the object which itself is lacking. The love that you feel towards an object is an indication that those features which you see in the object of your attraction are absent in you, and you try to make good the lack by a connection that you establish inwardly, psychologically, between yourself and the object. It looks as if you become whole when the counterpart that you lack is provided to you. But this is a mistake that the mind is making, because what you lack is something unintelligible to you. The love of objects of sense is an experiment that the mind is making in trying to find out what it is lacking. And life that we have in this world, so short, is spent in mere experimentation. Can you love an object eternally for all times from birth to death? That is not possible. You jump from one thing to another thing. Today this is desirable, tomorrow another thing. And what was desirable yesterday does not look desirable today. Because by an experiment, the mind has found that the object which attracted it yesterday is found to be inadequate today. So he tries an experiment with another object. And it fails there also. It goes to a third object. And with all its experiments, it finds that what it lacks, it cannot find. It cannot acquire. Because the mind is incapable of knowing what it really lacks. What we lack, what the mind is in need of, is not a temporary stimulation of the senses or the nerves. What it is in need of is not any kind of physical object. It is in need of something else, which it is trying to discover in the objects of the world. But no one has found one's object of ultimate quest in anything of sense, because the shortcoming of the mind is of such a nature that it cannot be made good by anything that is finite. There is an infinite shortcoming in the mind. And therefore, finite objects cannot bring it satisfaction. When there is an awakening into this fact, it tries to discover the causes of its failure. And take to right methods by which it can gain what it has really lost and what it really seeks. But the mind is wedded to the senses. It always plays second fiddle to the tune of the senses. And so even in its investigations into the causes of its failure, it takes the advice of the senses only. Because it has no other ministers except the senses. And so, in a life of renunciation, in a life of monastic discipline, etc., what the mind is trying to do is to act independently for its own self and discover the remedies for its sorrows. But in the act of this discovery of the causes of its sorrow, it takes once again the aid of the senses. And therefore, it comes a cropper. The senses begin to tell it once again the very same thing that they conveyed to it earlier. And we begin to interpret the causes of our suffering in this world in terms of the objects of the world once again, and there is a possibility then of our entering into a muddle. Which is the state of mental confusion. This is what is described in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Wherein, in which condition, on one side, we feel that we are in need of light, advice, and guidance from a higher power, a greater source of wisdom. But on the other side, we cling to our own views, stick to our guns. As Arjuna did, he was seeking for advice from Bhagavan Sri Krishna. But he was also arguing on behalf of his own feelings and opinions, as if they are right. So, in this confused state, the mind can get into an entangled situation where partly or outwardly it may appear to be engaging itself in a pious adventure of even the practice of yoga, devotion to God, etc. But it can become, unfortunately for it, a total sidetracked movement, a direction which it takes by the guidance of the senses. And it can be imagining that it is moving in the right direction, though it is moving in the opposite direction. All this is a precaution that masters of yoga, adepts, give us, so that we may not get caught up by the very same forces from which we try to gain freedom. Because freedom is an inward adjustment of consciousness towards the natural order of things, as we were discussing yesterday. Your harmony with the universe is real freedom, and the absence of it is bondage. And to cling to the objects, whether outwardly in their physical form or inwardly by way of mere conceptual thinking, would be once again bondage. Inward reveries are more dangerous than outward clingings, because the inner desires of the mind by which it enjoys subtly the pleasures of sense can be more vehement than outward clingings. As the Bhagavad Gita in one place still tells us, that even if you are physically away from objects of sense, the taste for objects will not leave you. Rasavarjam. Rasavarjam means you are free from everything, no doubt, but not free from the taste for things. And this taste for things is, it is that catches us. Taste means the feeling of pleasure in an object of sense. And the belief that the object of sense can bring us pleasure. This is the taste. And this taste is present in the mind in a very subtle form, like a highly potentized homeopathic dose. Very invisible indeed, but very powerful. And it can grossen itself into actual action when outward conditions become favorable. Once again, we are to repeat that any kind of diverting the mind from objects of sense is not the remedy for its cravings. Because it cannot forget that there are objects of pleasure. The yoga process is a process of education, which means to say a gradual enlightenment. An awakening into the daylight of knowledge and not merely groping in the night of darkness. Though it may be that you are moving from one place to another place in that dark night. Any amount of movement in the dark night is not going to give you light. Shifting of the position of the body in darkness is not a solution. The solution is the rising of the sun. And so, in the sutra which I was referring to in Patanjali's aphorisms, he says, Drishta anushravika vishaya vidrishnasya vashikara samjnya vairagya. Vairagya, or the spirit of renunciation, is a mastery that you gain over the objects of sense and not merely a forgetful attitude of the mind in respect of objects of sense. What are the objects of sense? Drishta and Anushravika are the words used. That which is seen and that which is heard. Both these are objects. You can cling to objects which are seen with the eyes and also cling to things which are only heard by your mind. When you see a thing directly, physically, of course, the mind will begin to read a tremendous, gorgeous significance in the object and jump upon it. Not merely that, even by hearing of the glories of an object of sense, the mind can become restless and ask for its possession. Like the joys of heaven, for instance. The celestials in Indraloka are supposed to be enjoying pleasures far superior to the pleasures of the earthly senses. Our senses can be worn out by repeated enjoyment. We may get exhausted. We may fall sick. We may enter into old age. We may die. But scriptures tell us that celestials, the devatas, the gods in the heavens, the paradise, their pleasures are qualitatively more intense their senses will not be exhausted, they will not be worn out, they do not get exhausted, they do not become old, and they will not die. That is a wonderful condition. We have to go there. So the mind can crave for such things also. Why such things are there? Why not I go there? So this is a desire that arises in the mind by merely hearing things which you have not seen with your eyes. But when you actually see it, of course, you are completely put out of order. All the ratiocinations of the intellect cease. The best brains stop functioning at that time, when an object of sense is presented directly. No brain will work at that time. The brain stops. But what is vairagya then, which the yoga speaks of? A vitrishnata, or a feeling of inward desirelessness towards everything that is seen or capable of being seen, and everything that is heard of, even through the scriptures or by other sources. In one of the writings of Acharya Shankara, he says, Abrahmastambhapariyantam vairagyam visheshvanu eteva kakavishthayam vairagyam tadrinirmalam. His definition of vairagya is terrifying. What does he say? Even the pleasures of Brahmaloka are to be despised by a desireless mind, even as it is mere dirt which has no essence in it. But who can imagine what the pleasures of Brahmaloka are? They are not like the pleasures of celestials. They are far superior even to Indra's pleasure. Because that is the description of the subtlest condition of sattvic enjoyment. Even that is an enjoyment only. Though this enjoyment is effected not through the physical senses, not even by an ordinary psychological process, but by a subtle instrument called the Anandamaya Kosha. They say in Brahmaloka, the physical body is not there. Not even the ordinary subtle body. There is a subtler still body, which is comparable only with what we call the causal body in us. Sanaka, Sanandana, Sanat Kumara, Sanat Sujata, and such others are supposed to be living there. Narada also. There are unthinkable things. These pleasures also are not to be coveted. In comparison with the greater joy still, which is identical with the self. Joy of the Atma, the Supreme Self, reflects itself in all these manifestations, right from the delight of Brahma or Creator, down to the grossest physical object of sense in various degrees. What is giving us joy, pleasure, is this Atman present in things. You are happy wherever the Atman is manifest. Where the Atman is not manifest, we cannot feel joy. Even in the grossest object of sense, the Atman is manifest. That is why it attracts us. It is a great wonder how the Atman can manifest itself in an object of sense. Is it possible? Yes, it is possible. And it is because of this mystery that is revealed through the objects that the senses run after the objects. The Atman is not an object, of course. And yet it is capable of getting revealed in some degree through the objects. The Atman is the symmetry of perfection. A well-arranged pattern which reflects completeness. And wherever this arrangement of completeness or pattern or symmetry is visible, the mind begins to feel that its object is present. Anything that is symmetrical attracts us. Anything that is confused or chaotic does not attract us. Symmetry is also a very difficult thing to understand. It is not merely geometrical symmetry that we are speaking of here, though that also is there as an element of this superior form of symmetry. Completeness or an absence of any kind of want is the character of the Atman. Many features are there in the Atman. It is not merely symmetry. It is difficult to explain what are the qualities that are discoverable in the Atma. Exuberance and buoyancy. Force. And symmetry, of course. Perfection. And freshness. The object of sense looks fresher and fresher every day. The more you see it, the more you like to see it. It doesn't look old. You do not say, I have seen it 100 times. Every day you like to see it, as many times as possible. Because freshness is one of the characters of the Atma. And we cannot know what this freshness is. It is not the freshness of a ripe fruit, like an apple. It is something that pulls your whole being. Every day the sun rises in a beautiful manner, we are happy to see the rise of the sun. We never feel that it is a dull sun that is rising for centuries. Every day it is fresh and invigorating and exciting. The capacity to excite you into a tremendous activity through every part of your body, the senses and the mind, is the capacity of the Atma. And wherever such inordinate capacity to stir the total personality is seen, upon that the mind jumps and it goes towards it. But it forgets that what attracts it is not this vehicle called the physical object, but something that is revealed through it due to a peculiar placement of that object in a certain atmosphere. In comparison with a peculiar and particular condition of your own mind in a certain stage of evolution. Attraction is impossible unless both cooperate, the object and your own mind. The object has to be placed in a proper context. It must reveal certain characters, and those characters and that context should be the very same thing that your mind is lacking at that particular time. Then you are attracted by it. And that is why you cannot be attracted by the same thing always, because the mind changes when you advance in age or in experience. Knowing all these things, the viveki or the man of discrimination gets disillusioned. Oh, this is the state of affairs. I am very sorry. I was totally mistaken. Parinama tapa samskara dukhaihi gunavritti virodhaccha dukhameva sarvam viveki. For certain reasons which are to be explained, the whole world is full of pain only. It is not a place of beautiful enjoyment or an occasion for exciting pleasures. There is something very terrible about this. What it is, this sutra that I quoted just now tells you, Hari Om Tat Sat.